This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to iFanboy's Talksplode with Ibrahim Mustafa. Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, ones we can depend on. Friends,
how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends. Friends is a word we use every day. Most of the time we use it in the wrong way. Now you can look the word up again and again, but the dictionary doesn't know the meaning of friends. And if you
ask me, you hey, it's another episode of Talksplode. I am Josh Flanagan of ifanboy.com. This is our creator interview podcast where I talk to comic book creators. And I mean, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. This episode, we have Ibrahim Mustafa, a guy I have known for quite a long time. We even did a pitch together way back when. But since then, he's gone on to do a lot of stuff in the industry. He's worked for Marvel and DC. He's done High Crimes. He's been nominated for an Eisner. Now he is doing Count with Humanoids, part of a 3-graphic novel deal that he has with them. It's kind of amazing, and I'm really glad we got to have this conversation.
Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboys Talksplode, and I'm here with Ibrahim Mustafa. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. And he's my friend, and this is the first time we've ever spoken, which is a thing that happens now.
Right. In like a decade.
Yeah, yeah. But that decade went really fast, to be completely honest with you.
Except for the last year of it. That's been 7.
It's an odd combination of fast and slow, but yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Just, I guess it's always important to me to be like, so here's the deal, so that people know. You were a listener of the show. Used to post on iFanboy a lot, and you reached out to me one time a long time ago and said, hey, if you want to work on something, and I went, oh, cool, and you showed me your stuff. And I've said this with other people. A lot of people would ask me like that, but many people were not really ready for prime time. And when you showed me stuff, I went, oh wow, you could do this, and so I was very excited about that. But you were. You said you were working in a hotel at the time?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you're so, like, I can do it in between the hotel shifts. And I was like, holy cow.
Yeah. When I decided that comics was the thing that I wanted to do, I was, through a series of jobs, I've been working since I was 15 years old and, you know, kind of just fell in from one thing into another in all these random ways. And I eventually found myself as a mattress salesman in a mattress showroom. And it was like 12-hour days, you know, because it was retail. So you'd be there from 9 to 9. And I was in school at the time and I had like split days off so I could go to school on Mondays and Wednesdays. You know, I was chipping away at community college. I was in my early 20s. And eventually I realized like I want to draw comics. And so I took the advice of a friend and found a service industry job, because I could work fewer hours and make tips, you know, to kind of cover the difference there. I found a job doing room service in a hotel. And what I would do is I would wake up every day at like 8 o'clock and I would draw until about 3 when I had to leave for work. And I'd work from like 4 to 11 or midnight. I'd come home. Sometimes I'd draw for another hour or two, go to sleep, wake up, do it all again. And I did that for like 5 years.
Jesus. You know, it's funny. This is terrible. But when you said that to me, I totally pictured a person in that little bellboy outfit, you know, with the hat and the suit thing. Right. And it, that little bit of that image is still in my head sometimes. It's in the background, but I thought, oh, that was the image that stuck in my head. So let me go back further from there then. So where are you from? When did you get into comics? How did this become a thing that you wanted to do?
Yeah. So I'm from the Pacific Northwest. I was born in Seattle, Washington, and then I've lived in the, you know, greater Portland area since I was about five. So I grew up here, which is funny because so many people, you know, migrate here for comics, right? And I just, luck of the draw, was like, oh, I'm already here. Cool.
Did you know that was it was a comics town, or did you find that out later?
Yeah, it was much later. I mean, there was sort of just like the generic knowledge of Dark Horse, Portland, right? Yeah. And so anytime you mention anything comics, people would say, oh, Dark Horse, but they didn't really know what it meant, right? Mm-hmm. But I wasn't really into comics. So, you know, when I was a little kid, you know, I grew up watching the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, and I was born in 85. So Ninja Turtles was like right in my age wheelhouse. So I had comics of both of those things, you know, Superman, Batman, Ninja Turtles. And then, of course, you know, I was the prime age for the X-Men cartoons. So I had, you know, X-Men comics as a kid, and you know, I always loved drawing, and I would draw superheroes all the time. And then, you know, as I got older, I kept drawing, but I sort of drifted away from comics and stuff. And then, you know, I got into like soccer, 'cause I'm the son of a Middle Eastern man. So it's like, you know, prerequisite. and I got into breakdancing in high school. And so that became like my entire life from the age of like 15 on.
Now when you say that, and I say this because when I was in about second or third grade, and I want you, I'm talking about a white kid from Maine, I get very into the idea of breakdancing and rap music at the time, but you're talking several years later than that. So it was almost like a retro thing at that point, really.
Yeah. I mean, there was still,
because I remember being like eight and seeing commercials for the Beat Street movie and going, I like something to do with that. And I don't know why. You know, like, but I brought cardboard to school in third grade, which is weird.
I mean, it was huge for, you know, like in the mid late 80s, right? It was just mm-hmm. everywhere. I picked up on it because, so I grew up in a single parent household, very poor. And my old middle school, you know, at the time I was a sophomore in high school when I sort of discovered it, I'd kind of been aware of it. You know, I knew some older kids who did a little bit of it, but they just kind of do like an arm wave thing, you know, kind of mm-hmm. make that like pulse go through their body. And I kind of taught myself how to do it from watching them. So I'd bust that out at like the middle school socials and stuff like that. But that was the extent of it. And then when I was 15, it was a Friday night, and my old middle school had a thing called Night Court, which was like a Boys and Girls Club sponsored basketball thing. You just go and shoot around, you could win, you know, Trailblazers nosebleed tickets, stuff like mm-hmm. that. And one of the guys who worked there was, he's about the age I am now, mid 30s, and he was like an old school dude from New York. So he grew up in Spanish Harlem mm-hmm. during, you know, the hip hop like birth, and so he was a break dancer and a graffiti writer, and he just kind of, he was teaching some other kids like some moves in the corner of the gym, and he was teaching locking, which, you know, a lot of people conflate popping and locking as pop locking, but they're two separate things. And locking is a very kind of like, it's almost goofy looking, right? And so I saw this, you know, to me, this middle-aged guy doing locking in the corner. I thought, I'll humor this guy, I like to dance. And then he started doing like some popping and like arm waves and stuff, and it just blew my mind. It's like watching a magic trick, you know? And he was willing to teach, so I was just like, oh my God, show me that, right? And so I just started going every Friday, and he was there, and he would just teach me. And eventually, you know, he's like a father to me now. I mean, we're
really
still close. And
that's,
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, he's like my real life Mr. Miyagi. It was like such a cool thing to happen. So
was there like a subculture of like,
oh, yeah.
more,
I mean,
like it, a bunch of people?
Yeah, it's a lot like skating, you know, like
right.
it's never died, yes. right? And there's, you know, you used to, before the days of YouTube and stuff, you could go to like Zoomies or Mr. Rags, you know, alternative clothing stores, and you could find like VHS tapes of like international breakdance competitions and stuff like that. So Yeah, you know, Portland didn't had a really thriving breakdance scene, but specifically the kind of stuff I did, like Poppin' and the Robot, which fit under the umbrella term of funk styles. That wasn't a thing.
I'm learning things I never, and I don't mean this to sound condescending. I'm genuinely, I'm like, really? I'm sitting here fascinated.
Know about it. Yeah. And there was a thriving online culture that, you know, that was back in the message board days. Right. Mm-hmm. So I was on there, and then, you know, you people would swap clips as sharing video became a real thing you could do on the internet. The summer after I graduated high school, my best friends and I went down to LA for this thing called the B-Boy Summit, which is like the San Diego Comic-Con of breakdancing, basically. And so, you know, I mean, there's always competitions everywhere. And here in Portland, just a small group of us really sort of pioneered like the funk styles and poppin' scene. It was a real thing for a while. I mean, I was teaching classes at different dance studios and running workshops and winning competitions and stuff. But, you know, much like comics, it's one of those things where it's like, it takes a lot out of you and it's really hard to make a living at. And as I got into comics in my, you know, late teens or 20s, it kind of became a thing where I was like, all right, I got to put all of my eggs in one of these baskets.
I've got to think that there's some connection between you thinking I can make a go at comics because it seems so much more realistic, right, than the even more niche and unrealistic breakdancing career.
Yeah, so, I mean, shit, if that's the comparison, right?
That's like, set you up for it, really. Whereas other people have been like, oh, that's too risky. You'd be like, you want to know risky.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, with comics, like the thing that got me back into them was Smallville. That had come on the air. I was in high school, you know, toward the end of high school. And I was like, oh yeah, I always loved Superman growing up. So, you know, I got into the show, and then somebody gave me a book that was like the complete history of Superman. And it had Alex Ross paintings in it that like sort of, you know, redid these old like Siegel and Shuster era images of Superman, right? That he put his Alex Ross realism spin on it. And I was just absolutely floored by that because I was always more into like a more realistic aesthetic. Like I was never drawn to comic book art necessarily as a kid. It was more about the characters. And so to see that, I was like, holy shit, you can do that? Like it never occurred to me. And so then that led me down the rabbit hole of, you know, finding his work, and then, you know, those oversized like Paul Dini books that he did, and then obviously Kingdom Come, and, you know, then I found more writers and artists that I liked, and it was just, you know.
So it's really, you really were pretty late on the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't start going to comic shops like regularly of my own, you know, on my own accord as you know, an adult with money until I was probably 19 or 20 maybe.
Mm-hmm. So how soon after that were you, I mean, were you kid, did you draw a lot? Were you an, you know, artistic kid?
Yeah, I was always drawing through that whole time. You know, and I always just drew stuff I liked. So for a long time, I was only drawing Mortal Kombat stuff, or I was only drawing like soccer players or breakdancers, or, you know, and I got into graffiti for a bit, which I was never very good at because it requires you to think much more abstractly. And that's just kind of not really how my brain works. But you know, when I discovered Alex Ross and then, you know, thereby like comic book art again, it was kind of like, oh, well, I like to draw already. So let me figure out how to draw this stuff. You know, and so I was just like, well, I'll just do what he does. And I learned what kind of paint he was using. And, you know, I started watercoloring and stuff. And
art classes, you know, like in school or.
Yeah, I was always like the kid who could draw in class.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And then I would take, you know, the art classes that they offered at school just as kind of like the, you know, everyone does it as like the bullshit elective or whatever. And then in community college, I started to focus on it more and I took watercolor classes. And that was kind of how I really started, you know, to like learn how to work with wet mediums and, you know, take it more seriously. And then from there, it was honestly just like kind of the, you know, drawing stuff I liked, YouTube University sort of path to it. And that's about when I discovered podcasts. There was an issue of like How to Break into Comics the Marvel Way, which is a thing they've only done a couple times. And Bendis had written a story and some new artist drew it, and he said, I found this guy through iFanboy or something like that. And so really? I just, it's like, yeah. So I was like, okay, well, Google, what is iFanboy, right? And then, you know, I found the podcast, and man, I got to tell you, you know, the video shows you guys did were like my crash course in comics. Like, I don't know if you've really talked to many people who are sort of here in the industry, like, because of what you guys did, but like, you know, the proof is in the pudding, my friend. I mean, I feel like,
you know, like we were there when a lot of people were coming up, but I don't think anybody's ever told us that. Although I thought, you know, that makes sense. I guess I'm guessing most of them just didn't make it the way that you did.
I mean, I've always had kind of a militant, like, you know, drive toward, like, well, militant is probably not the right word, but like a, you know, when I fixate on something, like, that's what I do, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I, you know, through watching those video shows, I just learned about like the backlog of stuff. I didn't know anything about it. I learned about different genres, you know, and at the time I had also, like, before that I had discovered Criminal, cause I was reading Brubaker's Daredevil, and I said, oh, this guy, you know, I like his stuff. Let me see what this is. And so then I found out about crime comics, and then, you know, through the show, it was like, oh, here's a deep dive into the genre and stuff. So yeah, man, I would just, you know, while I was working on samples and just, you know, drawing my own comics and whatever, like, I would just mainline those videos, you know.
that's really nice. I feel good about that. It's funny though, because when you say that, like, I think back to like what I knew or understood about comics at that point. And like, I had an idea of sort of how things worked in history, but like in terms of the art form, I feel like we were teaching ourselves at that time too. Sure. You know, like, we're trying to figure out how to talk about these things and what it was to notice that was important through this. So like, I look back on something, I kind of cringe because I didn't know what I was talking about. We learned how we were talking about because of it. Although 10 years from now, I might look back, you know, and be like, you didn't know comics at all when you were 44, which would be ridiculous. But
well, and I mean, you guys were really the only ones doing it. So it's like, there kind of was no wrong way, right? It was just what you were doing.
Yeah. Well, that's our curse, was to be just ahead enough of it so that we would miss like when YouTubers became a thing and you could have a job from that, or like at some point a friend of ours who's a, like, a big exec in at one of the companies was like, you know, if you'd done this 10 years early, you'd all have Porsches. And we're like, yeah, we know. Like, if the boom, like, if there were podcasts during their initial boom, like, we'd have been all set. But we were, you know, 8 years after that. It's fine, just the timing,
right?
Actually, I'm really proud of that stuff, though, because I think we've heard a lot of that. It's interesting because, you know, you said the X-Men cartoon, and then for people my age, it was Batman movie, you know, or like, you know, the 88, 89 stuff was like Death in the Family and the Batman movie. That was like, you have, like, Joker was everywhere. There was Joker and the Batman stuff everywhere. And like, that was us. And then I think when people came along later, a lot of the people who are closer to your age, you know, when the video show was first coming out, you know, animated X-Men people were a lot of it, you know, and this would be the first time that they could see anything like this. And I think that was attractive to people, which is, and it's kind of cool. I'm really proud of that stuff that we did, you know, and that now it, like, there wasn't other stuff around then like that. So we didn't get lost. If you did it now, you'd get lost. And I think that was the only good part about the timing, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, like you said, there's so much of it now, right?
Yeah.
Like, how would you even find, like, the one thing that does all of what you guys did, right? I feel like it's so spread out now that, like, I mean, it was real. Like I said, it was a crash course. Like, it was kind of like, you know, YouTube University in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for us too. I don't think we were even on YouTube at the time.
Right.
Well, you know, people ask us, they'll be like, well, what do I do if I start a podcast? And I was like, get a time machine. Like, you know, I don't know that we're necessarily any better at it than anybody, you know, at least, I mean, probably now after all this time, but at the time, it's just that there wasn't that much else around. So it let us get better at it because there wasn't any competition even for like attention.
Right.
So, which I think is one of the problems that comics has in general right now, is there's too much competition for attention.
Absolutely.
So many things. So, to get back on where we were, so you get interested in it, you start noticing the art and working on it, you're taking classes. Like, what's the bit where you were like, I think this is what I want to do. I want to draw comics.
Yeah. You know, I was doing the thing where I was finding like, oh, Marvel put out the, an issue that has like just Bendis's script in it or whatever. Right. Oh. And I was trying to find that stuff. And then, you know, at the time that stuff was difficult to track down. I found like an Astro City script, that was, you know, printed in the back of a trade or something. So I was trying to do samples based on that and, you know, just trying to get better. And, I started to learn that there were like two ways to break in. You know, you could either go to conventions and, you know, show your work to editors, or you could just kind of make a book and break in that way. Right. And I had tried the first way and I was not good. Right. And then,
yeah, like,
I mean, yeah, we never are when we think we were. Right. And even back then, like I knew I wasn't there yet, but like, all it takes is for you to see one comic that you think you could draw better than that comic, you know, the art in that book. And you go, well, if they could do it, I could do it. But, you know, you don't know what you don't know yet. And you don't know that it doesn't work that way. So, you know, I was getting some good feedback, but it was like I wasn't ready yet. And and that was kind of the, you know, and actually one of the
best. Did you know that at the time or do you know that now?
I know that now. I don't think I knew it at the time, but the thing that told me it at the time was a review I got from Bob Schreck, who wonderful guy, and you know we're friends to this day. And he,
oh great,
yeah. And at the time, you know, I didn't know him; he didn't know me. But he, I was aware of him because Diana Schutz taught a class at my community college, like on comics.
Oh wow,
yeah. Jeez. And so yeah, I mean, you know, and that was kind of one of the first like benefits of being in Portland that I was able to reap. Right.
Oh, and right. He was a Dark Horse at the time.
Yeah. And they were married at the time, or no, they were divorced, but you know, she brought him in as a guest speaker and like, she brought in Matt Wagner, who's her brother-in-law, you know? And, and so, the class was like it was a literary class and I failed it miserably because she had a very specific idea of what she wanted. And I thought it was, not that. So anyway, I learned a lot in it though. And you know,
it's gotta be really good for your ego to fail a community college comic book course. I mean, that's like, how many other people took that as a lark and you really cared about it and it didn't work out? That's, yeah. I mean, it did work out, I guess, but go ahead.
Well, you know, eventually I had a book come out through Dark Horse and it was kind of like, I guess I'm not failing now, am I, Portland Community College, you know? But, yeah, at the time, like, it was just a cool thing to like have, you know, Matt Wagner, who wrote and drew Trinity, which I loved, right? And stuff like that. And so at Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle, they would do these like, you know, this table has editors, you know, and so-and-so will be there from 2 to 4 and whatever. And so I did every single one of those and Bob Schreck was one of them. And I had written and drawn and self-published this, like first issue of this thing that was definitely going to be an ongoing that I was going to do, of course. Right. And, you know, I wrote, drew, colored it. Ed Brisson lettered it. You know, that was back when he was like a freelance letterer. And, you know, I met him through Pencil Jack or Digital Webbing, one of those two, right. Which, you know, again, message board days. And I was so proud of this thing. And, you know, honestly, like it doesn't look terrible looking back on it, but it's not great. And I had done everything with Micron pens and very clean and, you know, rulers and stuff. And there was a page that had a barn in it. And Bob Schreck said, look, you can draw, right? But he's like, there's something missing. And he goes, look at this barn. He goes, I know it's a barn. It's a very well-drawn barn, but I'm not going to step in any horse shit in this barn. You know what I mean? He's like, it's too pristine. You got to, wow. What are you inking with? And I said, you know, Microns. And he said, no, man, you got to get a brush. Get in there and, you know, just let the brush put knots in the wood and make it look gnarled. And, you know, and then he said, where do you live? I said, Portland. He said, perfect. He goes, go look up Steve Lieber. Tell him Bob Schreck sent you. Tell him Bob Schreck will kick his ass if you don't, you know, let him watch you, you know, if he doesn't let you watch him ink for a day. He's, you know, you buy him lunch, whatever, you know, learn some stuff from him and just keep at it. And I was like, all right, thanks, man. You know, and I had my mission. And then I was like, well, I'm at a con and Steve Lieber's right over there. And I knew who he was already. So I said, let me just go talk to him. So, you know, Steve was kind enough to, you know, take a good 20 minutes and go over my work and, you know, show me examples with a brush and stuff like that. And then he sent me to another artist who showed me some cool stuff. And so, you know, that was kind of the moment where I was like, okay, no, I'm not there, but now I feel like I have the tools to get there.
That's amazing. I mean, that like sort of the people were all in person and this didn't necessarily happen on the internet. And I mean, I think obviously you see where it helps that you're in Portland at this point, but I mean, Shrek, I think I had him on once a long time ago and it was for some innocuous reason. Like it was here's what's coming out this week kind of thing. And he was talking about a Jurassic Park book he worked on, which is kind of the saddest thing on earth.
Yeah, I remember that.
it's not sad. I mean, he's such a legend that I should have, you know, we should have been talking about anything else. Right. And you realize that he's the guy who's responsible for Frank Miller, you know, like, and just, right. all these geniuses that he brought in, Brubaker, you know. Wow. And then he told you to go over to Steve Lieber, who's, you know, you couldn't have even known how great Steve Lieber was then. Cause I don't think I'm still trying to understand like, oh, he's amazing. And just effortless and a super nice guy. So,
and he's the best guy.
Like, yeah,
absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah, it was cool, man. And it really, you know, from there I was like, okay, I'm going to do this right. And I got the Klaus Janson book on, you know, DC's Guide to Inking. And, you know, I already had the coloring one cause I had to teach myself how to color that, you know, certainly an ongoing book that I was going to do.
You're totally going to finish it. It's just 60 issues. Who cares?
Yeah. It was going to be my, you know, scalped. It was going to be my Walking Dead. Like I had a notebook. I had 14 issues planned so far, you know? So. And then, you know, I just kept trying to get better at it. And, you know, at the time I was really sold on like the binary idea of like, there's a writer and an artist, you know? And it was such a heyday that was when it was like the Marvel architects and mm-hmm. none of them were artists, you know?
Like, yeah.
So I just had it in my head, like, I'm not a writer person. And so I have to find people to work with. And that was, you know, part of my big search. And that was when I hit you up. Cause I had listened to so many hours of you talking about comics, and you know, then I found that you had like your website with your work, and I remember very specifically reading like an Arrested Development spec script that you did, and like laughing out loud at the time I read it, and I was like, this guy fucking gets it. Like, so I was like, let me hit him up, we'll see if he's interested, you know, and so it was just like a lot of, you know, putting samples together, putting pitches together and stuff like
and
that.
And we did a pitch. We did an official pitch. It went to Image, where my best friend worked, and it didn't matter. actually, I don't know if that was before that, but that's kind of how that went. It was okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, unless you know, I think that was before he went there.
It was.
Unless you know that you have to know someone there, you think that you will just be the person who magically gets to submit something and they're going to go, get this kid a book, you know?
Now I know a lot more about how that works and worked at the time.
The reality is that people who are doing books there half the time don't even know if the book is happening because they're like, am I going to get the email back? I don't know.
that's totally the case. I do remember that the first page, I want to say it was the first page of that thing, had this cool little inset thing that you did that was like looking through a like a scope of a gun at somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And I always loved that page. I thought it was beautiful.
And then I left panel stacked on the next page.
Oh, you did, you son of a bitch. I don't remember that, if that helps.
Well, good. But and so, you know, it was a lot of that kind of stuff. And that was when I was on the path of like, okay, I need to just make a book because mm-hmm. you know, they're always going to tell you what they don't want to see. But if you come to them with something that is complete, they kind of, you know, they can either say yes or no to it, but like they can't deny that you have done something and you're essentially giving them a resume saying, this is what my work looks like. And, you know, I saw people, you know, I think Chris Somney was probably the prime example of that at the time where it's like, he didn't have a conventional style, right? But he put out work. And, you know, I think Capote in Kansas, right, was like one of his first things.
Yeah.
And he started, you know, and then there was the comic twart thing that they were all doing. And it was like, you know, you're showing up and saying, here's what I do, hire me, rather than like, please, sir, may I have a job? Right. So, that was the route I was taking. And, I ended up doing, actually your buddy Charles.
I was going to say, they asked like, hey, can we hire him? And I was like, I mean, I'm not paying him, so I couldn't say no.
Right. Well, I remember at the time too, what you and I were doing was on hold because we were kind of like, okay, we'll wait and see if we get anything. And then I think that was also when your firstborn was coming and you had moved from New York. Right. So it was like, tons of life stuff happening. And, and so, you know, you were like, yeah, man, if you want to do it, like, you know,
please, was, by the way, that was the right call for you.
Well, it was. I mean, you know, the book, I mean, I don't even know if people know that I did it, and it's not something that I like, you know, actively promote. but what it did was make me, you know, 120 some pages better and give me a IDW credit to my name, which is like, okay, now people take it a little more seriously because I've been published, right? Yeah. And around that same time, I had joined a studio in Portland. I met, you know, that is one of the main benefits to being here is that there's usually some kind of signing event happening, right? Because there's so many people here and we have a lot of comic shops. And I met Brandon Seifert at some Things from Another World signing event. And we hit it off and he said, hey, you know, I'm part of this studio downtown of comic people. And, you know, we need a new member because somebody's moving out. So if you want to come by and take a look at it and see if, you know, you think it'd be a good fit. So I go in and I, you know, seem to get along with everybody. And so I was like, all right, cool. And, you know, Joe Keating was a member at the time and a few other people. It was small. There's maybe like six members. And so I did the bulk of that book there. And then, you know, Joe at the time was like, you know, up and coming and he knew a lot of people from being in the industry on the, you know, back end of things for a while. And so I said to him, hey man, I'm, you know, I want to find a project with somebody. You know, if you know anyone who's looking for an artist. And he said, all right, like, what kind of stuff do you want to do? I said, I really want to do a crime book. And he was like, all right, cool. And, you know, luckily he saw my work ethic, so he felt good about recommending me to somebody. And about 2 weeks later, he brought Chris Sabella by the studio and he said, you guys should talk. And Chris said, hey, I have this book that's been greenlit at Monkey Brain. It's this new digital first publisher. There's no money. Here's the book. Do you want to do it with me? And I was like, yes, because it was such a cool pitch. And that was the book High Crimes that he and I did together. And that book is the one that I basically drew like at the hotel. And I was like, so I was doing that thing where I was getting up early and drawing all day. And then I luckily being the room service person, I was kind of like, nobody really knew. There was only one of me at any given time, you know, it was like a one person department. So like nobody really knew where I was. I had a walkie talkie if I needed to be reached and I could just kind of be anywhere in the building at any time. So I would spend most of my time in like the little room service office if it wasn't busy, just inking pages or whatever.
So did you have to bring like all your like stuff? I mean, were you working on like 11 by 17 with like a bottle of ink?
Pretty much. Yeah. Wow. I found a pack that would fit pages without screwing them up. And, you know, like I was, you know, everything I did in my life was geared toward like maximizing productivity as much as possible. Right.
It's an incredibly mature like approach to it that you took. I mean, like, you know, forward thinking, I guess.
I think the thing was like, I was climbing without a rope, you know, I didn't have, you know, parental support. I had a long-term girlfriend at the time who did not give a shit about what I was doing and was, you know, not supportive of it at all. So I was like, you know, the band's going to make it. I'll show you kind of thing.
And, you know? And there wasn't like a backup plan. I mean, I guess you were going to community college, so you didn't like also have a degree in, you know, whatever. This is like the thing you were doing.
Yeah, like I had gotten my associate's degree and my plan prior to comics was like, I'm going to be an art teacher because I had good teachers growing up that, you know, were important to me. And it was kind of the only thing. I mean, you know, I didn't really have like, again, you know, growing up poor, it's kind of like you don't feel like you have a lot of options. You know what I mean?
You don't even know what the options are.
No, like I didn't even know you could get scholarships for like dumb shit in college. You know what I mean? Like I'm half Middle Eastern. I'm, you know, like I probably could have got something for that. Who knows, right? Like, I mean, there's stuff for everything, and you know, there's grants you can apply for and things like that. And you know, I was able to get financial aid for school, but you know, that was pretty much all I knew. And work always had to come first because I, you know, I had to pay rent and stuff like that. So I would take time off from school. I'd go back into it. And so I went to transfer to Portland State, and I found out like what most colleges do, I guess, which is like you have to take basically a year's worth of classes that don't pertain to your major at all, mm-hmm. you know, because they want you to be like, quote unquote, well-rounded, you know, as you're paying them exorbitant amounts of money. And I was like, I'm not doing that. So I said, you know what, I'm just going to take a year off from school and I'm just going to work and draw pages. And
you got an Eisner nomination.
Well, that eventually came. Yeah. I had enrolled in a graphic design program at that same community college because, you know, again, I was in that relationship and it was kind of like, hey, you know, you were 9 months into this year off and comics haven't happened yet. And, you know, I want the picket fence and the kids. So like, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, you know, she's right. Like, I need to be an adult, you know? And and so I had, you know, I did everything soup to nuts aside from lettering in that self-published thing I did. And as I was designing the logo for it in Photoshop, which I had taught myself, I was like, you know, I think graphic design could be fun. So mm-hmm. I was like, she's right. You know, let me look up the program at the school. So I did that. And then like, I think it was right after I enrolled in that program, I got that IDW, you know, indie book that, mm-hmm. that I just mentioned. So it was like
about a dog catcher.
Yeah, it was like a supernatural, like they were dog catchers, but it was werewolves. And
right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I drew the second volume, so they'd already done one of them, and the second one featured Proof, which I had learned about from your show, and I was like, well, this is the real deal, you know. So
I'm in now.
Yeah. So, you know, that preceded just like a miserable couple of years where I was like going to school and working and drawing comics. And I just hated like life. I mean, I was like no bandwidth, spread way too thin. Oh. But I, you know, had this pressure of like, I need to make it for, you know, my girlfriend and, you know, 'cause we're going to have a life together and blah, blah, blah. And then when that book came out, you know, I was fortunate enough to have like, you know, a good local community behind me and stuff. And so, you know, Things from Another World did this really great like release party for the first issue. And I remember she said to me, is that something I need to go to? And I was just like, okay, I don't think that I don't think we're on the same page here. So, you know, that kind of precipitated like the very serious discussion of like, I've been miserable for like a year now, and I've been pleading with you to like help me find some kind of a common ground here, you know, because she was a medical professional to some degree. So she had like a very well paying job, and I was still, you know, delivering room service and going to school. And there was no like, we're in this togetherness with her. It was like, there's yours and mine, and yours has to align with mine. And I just realized like, I can't keep doing this. And like, this person doesn't support what I'm doing. And so, you know, I just had a very frank discussion with her where I was like, look, I'll do this till I'm in my 40s. I'll live in a one room apartment with a mattress and a drafting table if that's what it takes. Like, this is what I'm doing. And she was just not down with that program. So I was like, all right, this, you know, this is where we part ways. And fortunately, High Crimes became a thing, and you know, we were doing it for no money, but it was coming out digitally through Comixology. And very shortly after the first couple issues came out, you know, luckily, like, we got two Eisner nominations for it, and Dark Horse, you know, gave us an offer to publish it in a hardcover. And so I felt like, okay, I'm not making money from this yet, but like, my foot is firmly in the door. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the beginning of like, all right, I'm doing this.
So I'm sorry, we're gonna go back without details on the thing. So the monkey brain thing was just for exposure. It was but Comixology wasn't paying for it.
So the way it worked was
it exists anymore, so I can ask these questions.
Right. Yeah. No, and you know, it was Chris Robertson and Allison Baker who were, you know, spearheading it, and they were wonderful. Like, so great to work with. And, you know, essentially what it was is, you know, they gave us this platform, and the only rights they retained were the digital rights. So, you know, we retained any kind of ownership and media and stuff like that. We could print it anywhere. It just couldn't be digital as well, because that was exclusive to Monkey. And then we got back end off the sales, right? So we did start to make money as it was coming out, but it certainly wasn't, you know, enough to live on or even offset any of the costs of making the thing. But you know, with that came, you know, a real shot at like, okay, we're people are taking us seriously now. And, you know, I mean, the Eisner nominations helped a ton.
Yeah.
As far as that went. And,
was there any push for you guys? Like, were you guys pushing to be nominated, or was it like a big surprise?
It was a huge surprise. Okay. I believe Allison submitted us for it, and we were nominated for best digital comic and best new series. And, you know, digital is one where you're like, all right, that's cool. But like, new series, we were up against like Sex Criminals that year, you know? that was pretty rad. And, you know, since we got the Dark Horse publishing deal, you know, it felt like things were happening. And then Chris actually started to get a lot of work after that. And that was really difficult for me. I mean, obviously I was super happy for him. You know, he's a dear friend, but I still had to draw this damn thing for no money. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it took us 3 years to do that book, you know, and it was, I think, like 140 pages or something like that. You know, and I drew it through like five different living situations and, you know, like two or three different relationships. And like,
were you drawing that? I mean, were you just drawing it like a traditional comic book? You weren't thinking about like necessarily like how Comixology cuts it up or anything?
No, we did it totally just like our end game was print.
Right. Okay.
And, yeah. And then, you know, from there, I started to get work once that was done. And that was kind of how I officially broke in and started to get, you know, like random fill-in stuff at DC and stuff like that.
So that's a lot of, like, how much time are we talking about then from, I guess, when you said, hey, this is kind of a cool thing, to when you start getting, like, actual paid work in mainstream comics?
Let's see. I started in, like, I think 2007 was like, I'm doing this. And I had done, I did a couple of like, you know, one-off independent issues with some guys I met on Pencil Jack that they printed and did a Kickstarter and all that stuff. And I found them recently and they're just dog shit. I mean, but you know, my part of it, I'm not speaking for anybody else, but, so yeah, you know, between all that stuff around 2007, and then I started to get like paid work in like 2014.
And my first thought is, and I know that that's a long time for you, that's not that bad. That's what I just thought.
In comics years, right? That's like, it's not terrible.
And now you have a high stress job that you never know when you'll be going to work the next day. So it's fine. Yeah. So that's everybody's got their comic story like that, and I think you know, you can see the grit and determination, everything that makes, you know, everybody's path is different, but they all include those same things. But what I think has been really interesting is, if I look at by the way, your webpage that has your work on it is delightiful and clear.
Thank you. I try.
Mustafa.com/comics, and there are all of your comic books all in one place. And I've got to tell you, for my job, that is the best way to do it. And so anyway, as I'm looking at that, though, I am thinking, you know, what has happened between that point and now is pretty goddamn remarkable, in that, you know, you at some point you have become a storyteller, not just an artist. You know, you've worked on a lot of sort of varied and interesting projects. You did some mainstream stuff, meaning, you know, DC, Marvel, but you know, the genre wise, you're kind of all over the place in a good way. you know, and now, you know, you've got this graphic novel series from Humanoids, and we can get to that and talk about it. But like, how do you, did you want this to be your route? Did it work out this way? Have you gotten very lucky, or did you say, this is what I want to do and have to go towards it? Because that's not usual.
Yeah, it was definitely the latter. And, you know, it's difficult because you, a lot of it, you're sort of left to the whims of like what kind of work you're offered, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, where the wind blows you. And I, Scalped is my favorite comic series of all time.
Excellent.
And yeah, and it, I mean, it's so good. And like, it's, I always, I think my biggest takeaway from that book is that to me, I go, that book fucking matters. Like, and I've never wanted to do stuff that like doesn't matter to a degree. I don't mean to sound like pejorative about anything, but like, you know, it's comics. Like there's a lot of stuff out there and not all of it is like consequential, right? Or doesn't necessarily stand on its own or age well, or, you know, matter in a couple of years or whatever. And so I think I've just always kind of gravitated towards stuff like that. That's a little more, you know, like less flashy superhero type of thing. And a little more like, this is a volume on a shelf, you know? Mm-hmm. not that I don't love that stuff and enjoy doing it, but sure. That kind of stuff also feels a little bit more like you have to dance for your dinner, and I don't enjoy that aspect of comics. Like, you know, and I found myself, the work that I was getting, like Big Two Wise, a lot of it started to be like, oh, we need to fill in. And because I was mm-hmm. fast and reliable, like, I was worried about becoming that guy, right? But also, like, you got to take what comes your way, like, because you don't always know where the next one is coming from, right? So, you know, I did some of that stuff. And then fortunately, I, you know, was offered some stuff at Vertigo. Jamie Rich is a guy who I knew locally. And then he ended up moving to LA and getting a job at DC. And he offered me, you know, like a straight up like Vertigo book, which I was like, yes, like Scalped is my shit. I'm doing a Vertigo book, you know? So Justin Jordan and I, with Jordan Boyd, who I met through you, did a book called Savage Things that was like, kind of like, you know, what if the government had a program where Jason Bournes were Dexters were kidnapped as kids and turned into Jason Bournes. What could go wrong, right? And it was totally like my cup of tea. And it was this sort of like espionage crime thing with some horror elements mixed in. And so that was really cool to do. And then I got to do Mother Panic Volume 2, which was the Gotham AD thing, which, you know, I'd been reading that book as just like a reader because I love the artists that were on it. And so, you know, I got to do that kind of stuff. And then the opportunity came up from our editor on – from Dark Horse on High Crimes, who, you know, helped kind of usher the book into, you know, its hardcover form. He started working at another digital first thing that was like geared toward tablets and smartphones. And, you know, he was like senior editor there, and he approached me. He was like, hey man, you know, pitch me something for this new venture. And I was like, cool. So like find a writer to work with. Or he's like, no man, you're storytellers, pitch me something. And that was the first time I ever had that, aside from the thing that I wrote and drew myself, that I was like, I'm going to publish this. That was the first like permission slip I got to like, no man, like do it.
But did you have like, I mean, had you had stories in mind, things that you wanted to tell just on your own? Like, I mean, it, just because, you know, it takes a while to sort of know what you're doing as a storyteller and like, where you're in charge of the plot and the structure and the characters and things like that.
Right. And I did have ideas. And a lot of them were based around like, this would be cool stuff to draw, or like, this would be a movie I want to watch or whatever. Right. But I'm not, you know, I listened recently to the Kelly Thompson episode that you did, the one that made it. And, you know, she was talking about how she isn't necessarily like the, you know, big world ending idea person. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel the same way. And
me
so,
too.
Yeah. And I think because of that, I sort of never cast myself in that light, but I did have these other kind of smaller stories that I had in mind. And so, you know, when I got that offer to pitch something, that was like, all right, well, I better figure out how to fucking do this then. Right? So, because I've never been one of those guys who like, you know, oh yes, the 3X structure, or like, you know, I've never had characters speak to me. Right. So I just thought like, well, if that doesn't happen, maybe I'm not the guy to do this stuff. Right. But I think I just have to work at it differently or harder or what, you know, approach it from a different angle maybe. So I, you know, pitched a story that got greenlit. I wrote, drew, and colored that. And then luckily I got nominated for like a best, I think, digital comic or web comic Eisner for that one. And so that really allowed me to say like, you know, hey, I'm presenting myself as a writer artist.
Is that Jaeger or is that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
You have to front sell your work, you know?
Yeah, my bad. Yeah. Yeah. Jaeger is basically a Nazi hunting spy story that I did.
It's gorgeous.
Thank you. You know, that was a, study Alex Toth and Darwin Cook's Parker novels.
Uh-huh. I can see that.
That I did. Yeah. I would really just, cause I was doing that sort of in between other projects, and like some days I would like, you know, draw a page of whatever I was hired to do at the time and then draw like a page or two of that. So, you know, I had to simplify my style to make it something that was, you know, and I wanted to do that experimentally too, to mm-hmm. kind of like push myself to, you know, try new things and whatnot. But,
I got to say, it's a fantastic cover. Like I just,
thank you.
It's a gorgeous book.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. Front side.
I don't know. I'll have to send you that right now. It's only, you know, I have print copies. I can send you a PDF of it if you want to see the whole thing. You know, that was another digital imprint that's like not around really anymore. So, but I do have, hard copies on my website, 48 page prestige format for anyone who's curious. and around the same time I was throwing my hat in the ring to do, James Bond stuff at Dynamite, 'cause I'm a huge James Bond fan. And luckily, Jeff Parker, who is a good buddy of mine, happened to be writing some of that stuff. And so I said, Jeff, let me draw it. And he was like, totally. And so
yeah, you did like, was it the back half of Origin?
Yeah. Initially, I was going to launch it. And then scheduling got weird. And then, you know, I had to step away and do other stuff. And then they got Bob Q. And I was like, God, how do I follow that guy? He's so good. Because of that, the opportunity to do a James Bond, like sort of one-shot holiday special came about, and I had successfully professed my love and knowledge of the character to the editor, Nate Cosby. And so he really championed me like getting to pitch writing and drawing it. And I had already pitched like an arc of the thing that Jeff and I did that we co-wrote together mm-hmm. after that. So, you know, me writing stuff was on the table, and because this was a one shot, I think it was kind of like they were willing to take a chance on it. And so I got to write and draw, you know, a 30 page James Bond one shot, which was like a dream come true for me. You know, I try not to be the guy who's like, I'll take the low page rate for the thing I love, but you know, I did it.
So, I mean, we're talking about a thing where you're not sure if you've got the chops to write at this point, you know, or like coming up with an original James Bond story to tell, that takes some cojones. I mean, that's not, you know, that would be intimidating for me, I would think. Like, did you know what you wanted to do with it immediately?
I didn't. And it was a really cool learning experience in that I don't always, I think what I learned from that is I don't always know like what I'm going to do or what the story is until I'm prompted with like, hey, figure out a thing for this. Right.
Yeah. No, I get that.
Yeah. Because I mean, I'm not the guy who's like, I have the Batman story in me to tell. Like, I think if somebody said like, hey, pitch us a Batman thing, I could probably figure out something cool, but I haven't been like sitting on this thing my whole life or whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. But with Bond, like I just know, I mean, you know, I've gone through almost all the novels. Like I've seen every movie. I know the structure of like a Fleming Bond story well enough that I was just kind of like, all right, come up with your own thing and just plug it into the formula, you know? Mm-hmm. And luckily that's what Bond fans like. So
yeah, no, that works perfectly. That's what you should do.
And so I think that helped, you know, be like a confident stepping stone for me in terms of like, okay, like I think I've figured this out, you know? And then with regards to the book I have coming out, you know,
hold on. I want you to do that and that's fine. But I do have a Bond question.
Yes.
How did you approach the look of your James Bond? Like, how did you decide what he was going to look like? Because that there's a lot of preconceived notions with that as a sort of character.
I love this question, Josh, because it's a important thing to me. I love Timothy Dalton as Bond because for a lot of reasons, but mainly he looks the most like the way Fleming described Bond, right? And Fleming even had this like there's an old crooner, I can't remember his name, Hoagie, and it's not Hoagie Carmichael, but maybe it was. Yeah, I think it was Hoagie Carmichael, who he's like, this is what Bond looks like in his head, right? Mm-hmm. So being aware of that and like the way he described the physical characteristics and, you know, kind of the Dalton influence, it all kind of went into a blender as far as that goes. But it was very important to me that it was the, you know, sort of my interpretation of the literary Bond.
Okay.
So the, you know, the comma of black hair over the right eye and the 3-inch scar on the cheek and the cold gray blue eyes and the cruel mouth. That's like kind of all you have to go on with Fleming's description other than he'd rather look like Hoagie Carmichael. Right. Mm. So,
That works. I get it. I think Dalton, I'm trying to remember. I'm not an expert, but I know enough that one of the Dalton movies, I think the first one's really good, and then the second one's not.
You know, I have a soft spot for both of them, and it's not a nostalgia.
Living
thing,
Daylights and is licensed.
A License to Kill.
Yeah.
Living Daylights is great.
Right. It's that's like a
great Bond movie.
And no one expected it to be any good and whatever, but like it's a great one. And the second one's like Miami Drugs or something.
Yes.
Yes.
However, it is much more faithful to the Live and Let Die novel than the Live and Let Die movie was in a lot of respects. Mm-hmm. And so I like it for that. And also, like, if you like 80s, you know, drug lord crime movies, like, it's pretty good. But I think because, you know, Roger Moore was, like, such an important Bond because he was the only guy who could, like, follow Connery and outsell him at the box office at the same time. I mean, literally, you know, Never Say Never Again came out like at the same time as A View to a Kill, I think. And it was, A View to a Kill. And so, you know, and Moore won out at the box office. So Roger Moore was such a beloved Bond to so, you know, an entire mm-hmm. generation. And then so when this serious guy, you know, this Shakespearean actor came on the screen and was like really doing it, doing his own stunts and stuff. They were like, what is this? Bond's supposed to run on alligators and wink at the camera, you know? And I think now because of, you know, Daniel Craig kind of doing what Dalton did, there's a lot more like reverence for those moves and people go back to him now, but
I'll that's my Bond out again. It's been a while. Hey, you know what? That leads to like, if someone was like, I don't know if I want to check out his Bond book. Now I think somebody has a reason to. It's
hopefully
years later and it won't do you any good, but.
So those writing credits helped me. And also, you know, to be quite honest, like, there are some very frustrating times when working for smaller publishers that do licensed stuff, right? And I use those frustrating times as fuel to make my own pitch for this thing that I wanted to do, which is this book Count that I have coming out. And so I would kind of chip away at that. And I was actually, you know, getting ready to pitch it to Vertigo at the time, but obviously that isn't a thing anymore. RIP Vertigo. You know, getting ready to go to a couple other publishers, and I was approached by Humanoids to draw a book that was part of this like shared universe thing they were launching. And I couldn't do it schedule wise, but I said, hey, I do have this thing I want to do, you know, because they were doing original content as well. And so they said, yeah, send it our way. And I did. And this is what the really cool part of it. Mark Waid is now the publisher at Humanoids, but at the time he was like an editorial or creative consultant. Mm-hmm. And he got his hands on the pitch and said, like, as he told me, like, you got to sign this yesterday, which was, you know, being that that's Alex Ross and Kingdom Come and Mark Wade. Yeah. And, you know, that was like my foothold into the medium. As
I know that you said you're not a three act structure person, but that's pretty good structure.
You know, a good point. I like that. And so, you know, they're a little coy about it at first. I don't know if that's like a French thing or what, but they were kind of like, maybe we'll, you know, and I felt kind of insane that I was, so the book is called Count, and it's my sci-fi reimagining of the Count of Monte Cristo. Right. And so here I was pitching a French sci-fi book to like the French sci-fi publisher. And I was like, there's no fucking way they're going to, you know, but luckily they were into it and here we are. And then from there, you know, Mark was promoted to publisher and he liked my stuff and working with me enough that he was kind enough to offer me a 3-book deal with Humanoids, you know, for original stuff. So after Count, I've got 2 more that are, you know, different things, not sequels or anything. So I've got some stuff locked in for a bit, which is cool. So
that's amazing. You know,
thank you, man. Yeah. And to answer your earlier question, like that was kind of my goal, is I want to do like original stuff that I write and draw, you know, and just like get paid a living wage to do it. So
I mean, that's kind of the dream, really.
Yeah.
Like that's what everybody should be going for, you know, in the way, and not everybody gets there. And that's kind of rad.
it's super awesome, man. And but it's funny, you know, it's a double-edged sword too, because I haven't done like a big run on a big 2 thing. Right. Like, I mean, you know, I did 6 issues of Mother Panic, but like, you know, that was a kind of a niche pop-up imprint thing. And so I haven't been able to build like the kind of readership that one hopes for off of stuff like that to kind of like fulfill the Kirkman manifesto to then take it to your independent stuff. Right. So, you know, that is probably hopefully still something that I can and should do at some point.
I feel like if you're talking about a place like Humanoids, they're not necessarily selling books based on like the name doing them, at least certainly not to an American audience who doesn't know a lot of their, you know, their creators anyway. It'll be kind of interesting. Right. Like, so what I'm getting at is like, I'm assuming they don't expect you to bring a big audience to it in the same way, because it's not like they're not aware, you know, the kind of stuff you've been working on here, which is kind of an opportunity, I guess.
No, I think you're right. I think there's the part of me that goes, you know, like pragmatically, they're a business and these things need to be economically viable. And so like, I better sell copies of this damn book, right? so to keep me around. And so, you know, with that comes the like, okay, well, you know, if I were to draw, you know, a bunch of issues of something that people buy just because of the masthead, that would probably be helpful, right? Because mm-hmm. then you're hopefully capturing 2 audiences, the people who care about what you're doing and the people who learn about what you're doing that's off to the side because of, you know, this more like in the spotlight thing that you did. So, you know, it's weird. I feel like there's kind of this cycle of like, I broke in, got to do some mainstream stuff. Now I'm doing, you know, higher tier independent stuff, and I'll probably have to break into the mainstream again to some degree to do that stuff. If that's the,
you're assuming there even is going to be a mainstream.
This is true. This is true. Yeah.
I mean, that's who, at this point, who knows? All bets are off. You should probably stick with the French if you can.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have over the last couple of years, they've built this, LA branch of their office, which is where a lot of their, you know, English stuff is coming out of, which is, you know, what my work is a part of. So it's cool. You know, it's cool to be like on the early end of a thing like that. And, you know, I mean, they're such a great like prestige publisher. So I just feel honored to like be able to do stuff with them. And, you know, Mark Wade he's on my creative Mount Rushmore. Right. So, you know, being able to you know, collaborate with him in any capacity is super cool, and, you know, learn from him, from his notes on scripts and things like that. So Yeah, I'm just trying to soak it all up, man. You know.
So what's the deal with Count? I mean, like, I know that it's the Count of Monte Cristo, which is something I haven't read, and I haven't seen the movies. Like, is this a story that you really familiar with and you love, and you had this idea?
Sort of. I love revenge stuff, like, as a genre, right? Okay.
Yep.
And like, I don't know, something about people getting their like due comeuppance. It just like, I love it. and you know, which in my book, Jaeger is a revenge story of this guy who was, you know, like held in Nazi prison camps, and now he's out hunting down Nazis. And so I had done that, and I was, you know, thinking about like cool revenge stuff. And around that time, John Wick came out, and I was like, what is like the granddaddy of all revenge stuff? It's gotta be Count of Monte Cristo. Right. And at the time I hadn't read it, but I had, you know, I'd seen the 2002 right. movie, and so I found an audio version to listen to while I was drawing, and turns out it's pretty long and, it's pretty dry. Like, there's not, you know, it was written by Alexandre Dumas, and I think he was paid either by the line or the word. I can't remember which, but, and you know, it shows, like, the thing is like something like 1200 pages. And
how long was the audiobook?
Hours. And it was like not an official one. I found a guy who just like read it out of the goodness of his heart.
Jesus.
I'm like, yeah. So
you got to pay for that. You can't be going with amateurs on that.
Yeah. I mean, he was great. I wish I could remember his name to plug his site or something, but I don't know if he still does it, but, yeah. And so I just thought, like, I mean, you know, because Dumas wrote it and he also wrote the Three Musketeers, I think people assume that Count of Monte Cristo is very swashbuckling, but it's not. Like, it's like a soap opera, you know? And so I just kind of thought, like, damn, what if this was like an action packed thing, right? Like, and then I thought, you know, that, you know, 1700s, 1800s France, like Napoleonic France, is not the most appealing time to like a broad swath of people. So I thought, what if it was like a cool, like, otherworldly sci-fi thing? And that kind of was the germ of the idea. And then from there, I just kept thinking about it as I was working on other stuff and starting to put that pitch together, and, you know, did a bunch of world building. And that kind of led me to this thing where I was like, okay, so I'll take the sort of broad strokes of this, you know, literary classic, and then inject my own sensibilities and storytelling stuff into it. And so I essentially made it it's 120 page OGN that's like, you know, kind of like a movie in the sense that, you know, like I love that experience of sitting down and reading a graphic novel cover to cover and feeling like I just had a meal, you know, similar to like sitting down and watching a 2-hour movie. So I really wanted to convey that sort of feeling within this book. And so, you know, there's like, you know, hovering vehicles and stuff. There's cool androids. There's, you know, tons of sword fights and action, but it's really like, I took it and made it a story about revenge and retribution, but also, you know, kind of like revolution. And, it's much more of like a, you know, sort of a societal, like, you know, these people are trying to fight for a change in their world, and the main character has to decide if his revenge is more important or like the greater good.
Mm-hmm. The greater good. Sorry. I can't hear that phrase without repeating it.
Spoiler alert.
It's just impossible. No, this, all right. So there's two questions that I have about this. One, so when you pitch this, you know, they said, do you have anything? I have this, like, how confident did you feel about it?
I felt really good about it. Like, the pitch, I made like a 5 or 6 page PDF. I had character designs, you know, I had the standard like pitch document that, you know, you would write up. And then I had character designs and synopses for them. And I had, you know, some of the world building stuff, like a couple of vehicles and, you know, like the prison that the character is sent to is this, like, you know, in the book, it's an island. And so I made it this like floating island, you know, that's like impossible to escape from. I should go real quick. The premise to the you know, my version and the original classic is like a young guy is, you know, kind of got the whole world out in front of him, and he is falsely accused of treason by jealous rivals who, you know, conspire to send him away to this prison for the rest of his life. And within the prison, he meets another prisoner who is trying to escape. And he, you know, essentially like learns from this guy, you know, he's kind of a mentor to him. And the old guy knows the whereabouts of a fortune, right? And so the goal is like, when we break out of here together, we're going to amass this fortune and, you know, go to say Wataneo, like Shawshank Redemption, right? So eventually he escapes and uses that fortune to exact his revenge on the people who, you know, set him up. And so, you know, that was partly by design that I was adapting this pre-existing thing, because I've always had this thing of like, they're not going to let me do it. Mm-hmm. I don't have enough credits to my name, whatever. So let me give them something that they can chew on, you know, and then put my own visual spin on it, which is my strength as an artist.
So, I mean, but it's one thing to be like, you felt good about it, but it's another thing to like that they would go ahead with it. Did you think I have a shot with this? Like, you know, your own work is good or that you're happy about it. I think that's like, were you surprised that it went, or were you like, that's right?
Well, you know, I felt good about, here's the thing. Like, you know, there's a lot of talk of imposter syndrome in the creative stuff, right?
I'm totally talking about that without meaning to, but yes.
I feel very fortunate. I don't suffer from that because I know how fucking hard I've worked on this stuff. You know what I mean? Like,
that's great.
I certainly know that, like, I think a lot of imposter syndrome comes from, we thought we were really good at this stuff, and then 10 years later we go, God, I was terrible and I thought I was awesome, so I must be terrible at it now. And in 2 years I'll go, oh, I was awful 2 years ago, right?
Well, to be fair, I'm sitting here as a person who you just said you learned a lot about comics from. And then we worked together when you were working at a hotel and I was like, I think I got something. And now I don't do any of that stuff and you're selling books. So I've definitely, I don't know if it's imposter syndrome, but something happened there. I don't even mean that, like there's literally no resentment or anything. I think it's amazing. There's a couple of people I know who I'd worked with long ago and like, I'm so proud. Jordan Boyd. You know, like, and I'm proud of you in this not really paternal way, but I was like, if nothing else, I was like, well, at least I can say I saw something in this stuff a really long time ago before anybody else did. I think that's so cool.
Man. Well, yeah. Honestly, dude, your you know, willingness to do something with me back then was like a confirmation for me, right? Because, I mean, here's a guy who I follow on these various, you know, platforms who clearly knows the medium and has cool things to say about it, which is what made me approach you in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right. So to get your cosign was a big deal for my development, you know? And I think because I was able to build like a strong vocabulary of what I knew I liked and what I felt the general consensus of like, this is what works in comics. Like, I guess I feel as long as I'm doing that and striving to get better at it, then I belong here, you know?
That's awesome.
So, yeah, I guess I felt like the pitch was good and, you know, there was still, it still remained to be seen if like, okay, well, if they say yes, now I got to make sure I can do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that's what I thrive on creatively. And so, you know, that's what makes it easier for me.
I mean, having a job and having a deadline, you're like, those are the best things for me to.
Yeah.
It's like, that's almost one of the hardest parts about trying to come up is that you don't have those things, you know, you know, there's nobody demanding it from you. So.
Yeah. You know, and that's why it was really important for me to demand it of myself, right? Like I have very regimented days and, you know, for a long time, I mean, I've kind of relaxed now because, you know, I'm married and nobody sees me anymore, but like, I would wear a tie in my own home every day. You know, I'd wear suspenders and slacks and like, I was dressing for work, man, because, you know, I heard John Van Fleet say in an interview one time, you know, yeah, people always say, oh, man, it's great. You don't have to wear pants. You can wear your pajamas to work. And he goes, yeah, but when are you not in your pajamas? And I just was like, goddamn, he's right. Like, you know, I feel like if I wear sweatpants, I want to do sweatpants things, you know.
I will say I work from home. I've worked from home for 12 years now, and I get dressed every day.
Yeah.
And my wife's like, I don't get it. Why? And I was like, I don't want to be in pajamas all day. And that's exactly it. That's, I think, you're the first person to ever articulate that in a way that I totally understand it. Cause like when her and my kids are home, like on the weekends, they don't have anything to do. They don't, I was like, ugh, get dressed, you filthy people.
Right. I gotta shower before I do anything. I gotta, you know, it wakes me up, sets me off for the day. And you know, I just feel blessed to be able to take a hot shower every morning. Like that's kind of like part of my ritual. Like, man, this is cool.
Oh, it's the best.
Know? We just lost power for 5 days in a
oh my god
ice storm, and like, man, I've never been so grateful for heat and light. Let me tell you.
Do you have a generator?
No,
I guess that lucky. Doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, you know, we have like a gas boiler and range, so we were able to cook and take showers and stuff. But oh, yeah,
jeez,
yeah, it was fun. So
yeah, I've been through that. I've been through that here. It wasn't. It's not fun. Yeah. I guess if I was to end this now, it would be perfect because of the way that we just ended that conversation. But I did have another question because of the size of the project that you're working on, Count. And I want to say the Count, but it isn't. It's Count. But
correct.
I really want to add an article, but I'm not going
Everybody
to.
Everybody does. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're doing that much of a thing in scope, you're conceiving, you're writing, you're drawing, you're designing, like what is your favorite part of that to do? And what is your least favorite part of that to do?
Oh man, that's a really good question. You know, there are, I guess the boring answer is there are aspects of each part that I love. Like when I'm doing layouts, like, cause just a quick process overview.
Yeah. That's sort of coming up when I was asking, I was like, okay, do you script it? Do you?
Yeah. They wanted full script and actually, really? You know, yeah. And because I was yet sort of untested as far as they were concerned, at least I'd never worked with any of them before. So I had to write like a full, like beat sheet synopsis. Like basically if you were to just see a movie and then tell your friend about it scene for scene, like that's what I did for them in written form. Which was actually a great exercise because it helped me figure everything out. Right. Like I had that shit airtight by the time I sent it to them. Which I guess was another part of like, you know, feeling like they weren't going to say no, because I was like, how can they look at all this work I did? And it's watertight, you know? So, you know, it was like a tentative yes, but we want to see a little more before we greenlight it. Right. So once I had that, I mean, dude, I wrote this script for this, you know, 120 pages. I wrote it in like 10 days.
Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, cause you know, when you're drawing, like, it's so much work, like sitting down and writing, like, are you kidding me? I just have to type, like, this is great. Like I was writing 10 pages a day, you know, and I had this tight outline. So it was just kind of like flowing out of me, which is really cool.
How much did you like visually plan it in your script?
You know, there were certain moments that I knew I wanted to do visually. And so I would write those in partly to tell them what I wanted to do. And also as a reminder to myself.
Right.
But if I had a least favorite part, I think it would be the scripting.
Sure.
Because like it's way more tedious for me, and it's like I just want to, if I could just draw it, or at least if I could give myself like a one sentence synopsis or something, or a paragraph synopsis for each page or whatever, I feel like I could work faster. But you know, the logistics of this is they need a script, they need to edit it, they need to catch any you know, continuity errors or whatever. You got to get a page rate for that script, so it's just kind of like it is what it is, you know. And then I'll do layouts digitally. Like I'll do four on a page essentially. And I do them in like cyan and magenta so I can separate elements. I'll send those off for editorial notes. You know, usually it'll be like, oh, let's make this panel a little bigger, or, you know, hey, make sure this is clear in the final or whatever. And then from there I print those out on paper, at a reduced opacity. So I can still see the construction, but I'm not, you know, it's not going to show up when I scan it as badly. Go ahead.
So they're pretty hands-on in terms of like through the process. It's
yes.
It's not Image Comics. It's not, you know, you hand
no, I, yeah, I have an editor, Rob Levin, great guy. Fantastic editor. Every note he gives me is just like, oh yeah, damn it, he's right, or I should have thought of that, or yeah. You know. So that's a really
awesome.
Great part of the process. Yeah. You know, and also because we make this stuff in a vacuum, right? So to have another pair of eyes on it that you trust going like, hey, this works, hey, tighten this up, et cetera, you know? And then once I get the A-OK on the layouts, I'll print them out and I pencil and ink over those. I still work traditionally. I've done digital, you know, I did like a year of digital work on James Bond Origin and Mother Panic, and it was a great experience. But in the end of the day, like, all the things I love about drawing are inherent to the traditional, like, physical tactile version of it. So
I gotta say, you must, okay, if I were you, I'd be thinking of that thing that Bob Schreck said all the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Cause it's, I've never heard that note, but I feel like I've had that thought, you know, like that I hadn't formed into something. Right. And it's beautiful. Like, if I think about the artists that I really like, I'm literally looking at a Gabe Hardman, a piece on my wall, yeah. You know, and I can see the brush, you know, I love seeing the brush. It's one of my favorite things. And then that brush look like a thing.
Yes. There's something about like physical, like traditional brushwork, mm-hmm. is the only kind of inking that can be lush. Yeah. Right. And I just like, I love it, man.
Yeah,
and it's not, when you use different brushes and pens and nibs and whatever, like they all have a different relationship to the paper, and the paper can make that different, you know, the temperature in the room. And when you're drawing digitally, like, it's such an awesome tool and so many people are doing such awesome stuff with it. For me, I can't get past the fact that it's like a nib on glass, no matter what mm-hmm. preset brush I'm using. Right. And
yeah,
so
I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then from there, you know, I scan the pages in and send them off. And I've been working with this colorist, Brad Simpson, who's just a genius. Like, it's like he knows what I'm thinking. And so he colored Count. And then we have Hassan Otman El-Hao, who's lettering half of comics these days.
Yeah. I've been seeing his name a lot.
Yeah. And he's brilliant. He's a letterer who like really does storytelling stuff. And it really elevates the, you know, like he'll do like a squiggly line to like a someone who's in distress or whatever, uh-huh. right? To stem from the balloon and stuff. Like he's really great. So, yeah, that's, man, awesome. It's a great, you know, thing to be a part of.
I'm really happy for you. I think that's fantastic. And thanks. Because the last 10 years of my life feel like a blink. You've accomplished a lot quite quickly, but I know it was a heck of a slog that you drove yourself through. So, it's a good story. It's a damn fine story. Now just don't blow it. No.
Yeah. Right.
Count's but done. You're already,
doesn't suck if, yeah.
You can't do anything about it now. You just do the next one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that was so much fun. Thank you. I'm glad to meet you, even though I know you.
Likewise. Oh, and if I should like formally plug Count, I guess, while I'm here. Right?
Sure. I mean, yeah, go for it.
It's coming out March 16th to bookstores and March 17th from comic shops. March 16th is also my birthday. So
hey,
I would love it if you, you know, join me in the serendipity there and pick up a copy. It's if you go to countcomic.com. You can watch a trailer that I put together for it. You can order it, you know, via Barnes & Noble, Amazon, bookshop.com, or, you know, you can pick it up at your local comic shop, which is always the preferred means if you're able to.
Especially now.
Yeah.
For
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Well, it was awesome. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, man. This is great. I'm glad we finally got a chance to chop it up for realsies.
That's a phrase I've never used and I'm never going to.
Nor will I ever again.
Thanks.
And that was that. I hope that you had as much fun listening to that as I did having that conversation. Go check out Count from Humanoids. Check out High Crimes. Check out all of that other stuff. Go to Ibrahim's website and you can see some of the cool work that he's got on there. Thank you to the patrons who unlocked this show many moons ago and brought it back from dormancy. It is a great thing that I get to do, and I really appreciate that. And go to ifanboy.com. You can comment on this. You can find other stuff that we have recorded. You can find 94 other Talksplodes, most of which I did, but some of which I didn't. So those go way back. It's a little history of comic books there. That's ifanboy.com. And of course, if you want to contribute, you can go to patreon.com/ifanboy. Thanks very much, and I will be back here with another one of these at some point soon-ish. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, like, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.